God, just ask for your presence here with us tonight. Ask that you would slow us down a little bit. You would give us some space, some calm to reflect. I pray that you would show up tonight. Pray that as we look in your word, that you would show us something of you. Pray that we would be confronted by who you are, that we would see you in some way. I pray that it would change us, that it would be something significant. God, we just ask you to be at work in our lives. We know you are. And we know you're at work in this group, in this community. We pray for that work. We ask you to continue to work. And we trust that you are and ask you to build us up, to help us to know you better, to love each other deeper, and to love the world more. So we give this time into your hands. We trust that you will use it and it will glorify you. In Jesus' name, amen. I want to start by reading a poem called Into My Heart an Air That Kills. You probably know that one, right, Mark? It's by A.E. Houseman, who's a poet. So listen to this poem. Into my heart an air that kills from yon far country blows. What are those blue remembered hills? What spires, what farms are those? That is the land of lost content. I see it, shining, plain. The happy highways where I went and cannot come again. My question for you is, what does this poem mean?
Can you read it one more time? I'm not trying to be
argumentative. No, I was going to suggest that.
Okay,
so the question is, what does this poem mean? I'll read it one more time. Into my heart an air that kills from yon far country blows. What are those blue remembered hills? What spires, what farms are those? That is the land of lost content. I see it shining plain, the happy highways where I went and cannot come again. What does it mean?
It sounds like nostalgia to me.
Okay. Nostalgia, again?
I would say nostalgia or erring on the side of regret, maybe.
Mm-hmm. Regret.
Something that was one that was lovely that we chose to leave or had were forced to leave or couldn't and can no longer participate in whatever that is.
Yeah. Yeah,
it sounds like home to me, where it makes me think exactly of home where I'm not going back.
In a good way. Like you want to go home.
Like I want to go home.
But you can't.
But I can't. Can't go home again.
Anybody else?
I don't think that's not a positive. I mean, it clearly doesn't have the air of positivity.
Not a happy poem?
No. Not in the least.
And that word kill, kind
of. Is there a kill in it?
What was the title? Oh,
the
air. Into my heart an air that kills.
Kills, yeah.
Yeah.
Like you're taking my breath away, kind of, you know. I can't, whatever that is, I missed or can't return to or whatever. And you're kind of, this sucks on this side.
Nostalgia does have a bit of a regret and an anxious stomachache that comes along with it, and a like, man, those days, like a longing for those days. Mm. There's a longing that goes with it because you know that like. You can't get back to that place. Or that simplicity or whatever it is that you're nostalgic for. It's a,
mm-hmm. Anybody else? Eusebius. Summarize this poem in one sentence for me. Give me a statement, a sentence that is the meaning of this poem.
I've never been. I became an engineer, so I learned.
I know, that's why I want to ask
what
you.
What is English stuff? I wish I did things differently.
I wish I did things differently. Okay, good, good. Anybody else want to take up my challenge, or should I pick on one more person?
Yeah, well, you can't go home again.
Yeah, so I was going to say,
that kind of whatever that adage is, whatever it's called.
So there's longing, there's regret, there's nostalgia. What I want to do tonight is, okay, well, let me ask you this question. What's more powerful? What was your sentence?
I wish.
I'm an engineer and I don't read literature.
There we go.
You didn't say that.
That's what I heard.
I wish I did things differently. Yeah.
Okay. So which is a more richer, fuller statement? I wish I did things differently or what I just read? This shouldn't be a tricky question. Whatever, thank you. Okay.
What's wrong?
So, no offense to the engineer's statement. It's a perfectly accurate statement, and in some ways, they say the same thing, right? There's the same truth, the same element to those statements, right? But one is fuller, richer. It gives you emotions that you remember from home. It gives you, brings up things in your mind, the air that kills, I mean, it's evocative, it's something powerful, right? Well, tonight what I want us to do to kind of look into this series that we're going to be beginning is to look at Genesis 1. And my suggestion for us is that Genesis 1 has a very, very simple statement of what it means. I'm not going to tell you quite yet what it means, but that statement for Genesis 1 is actually very simple, and yet Genesis 1 is a much more powerful way to communicate this truth in the rhythm and the nature of this creation account that we have. It communicates a very simple truth, but in a very powerful way, just like this poem does. And in fact, it connects with some of the even themes. Some of these themes of this poem is longing, nostalgia, this kind of desire for something maybe that once was, and yet you want it. And one of the things I've noticed in kind of talking with you guys and being around is there's some themes that seem to come up. Kind of, if I were to call you at a random point in the day and ask you, what are you frustrated about right now? Probably a good chance it's in one of three categories, right? Your job, your friends, or your significant other, or lack thereof. Is that
not family?
Fair?
Family's not in there at all?
Yeah. Okay, maybe let's put family in the friends category. Your relationship's non-romantic.
Okay.
Let's make that category. Larger. Is that pretty fair? Hit about maybe 98% of the things? I mean,
99.9%.
Most of them.
Lack of toilet paper, that's quite frustrating.
Lack of toilet paper, sure. Sometimes you stub your toe, and that's a whole different category. But most of the time, it's going to be in one of these categories, right?
Health.
What's that?
Health,
that's true. That's a good one, yeah.
And that goes with stubbing your toe and not having enough toilet paper, right?
True.
That affects your health.
Right. Health is that's true. And it's more significant, probably,
for others,
for people that are wrestling with health issues. It's a good point.
I wasn't trying to make light of it, seriously. I'll try to listen and be more sensitive.
So what I want to suggest is that these are areas that are significant to us, they're core to us, and in all of these areas I think there's some sense of some of the emotions that this poem even raises, some sense of longing, some sense of desire, some sense of something that could be, maybe we once had a taste of it and yet we don't anymore, maybe we want something more than we're experiencing. What I think is that when we follow those desires, when we follow those longings, we get to something within us that I think speaks of who God is and who God has made us to be. And that's what we want to that's where we want to start tonight, is understanding a little bit of that. We want to understand kind of when we follow those threads, I think we get to some real core deep things about us, but even deeper about God. And that's what we're going to see in Genesis 1. So, the simple point of Genesis 1, the thing I could say, essentially, say these three words and we could be done. You might prefer that, but I won't. Is God created us. Okay? That's Genesis 1. God created us. That's the point. Not particularly, probably doesn't, you're probably not like, oh, wow, that's like, I've never heard that before. That's incredible. You can't be serious. I mean, this is like standard stuff, right? If you have been to church, if you are kind of familiar with the Christian story, this is the first thing you learn, maybe. And yet that phrase, I think, is unpacked in profound ways. And the implications and the challenges that that simple phrase poses to the way we operate in our world and the way we expect to operate and people expect us to operate are actually really far-reaching. So that's a little bit of what we want to do tonight, is look at Genesis 1 and see how that phrase really affects us. And it begins with God. So, does anybody have a Bible open? We're not going to read all of this passage because it's long and familiar to probably some of us. But I want to start just by having somebody read the first three verses. Genesis 1, 1 to 3. Somebody could read that.
In the beginning, God created the heavens and the earth, and the earth was formless and void. And darkness was over the surface of the deep, and the Spirit of God was moving over the surface of the waters. Then God said, "Let there be light," and there was light.
Okay, so one of the things when you look at Genesis is you get into a certain type of discussion with people, right? There's a lot of people that debate creation issues, and I just received an invitation today to some conference on creationism, kind of arguing for biblical creationism, which is a fine thing to be interested in. But what happens is when you start talking about Genesis 1, most people are interested in the mechanism of creation, right? How did creation happen? And we get in all these debates about, was it 7 days? Was it seven periods of time? Was it this? Was it that? I don't think that's what Genesis 1 is about. I don't think that Genesis 1 is about how long creation took. It's not about the specific mechanisms through which creation happened. What Genesis is about is the one who was behind creation. So Genesis 1 argues that God created us. And it begins with God. In the beginning, God. That's how everything starts. And I have to understand that Genesis was written by Moses. So Moses has just led his people, God's people, out of Egypt, right? They've been slaves in Egypt for 400 years. They've left Egypt, and now they are going to be God's people. Now they are going to start the nation of Israel. And if you're a Jew in the Old Testament, then this is where your nation began. This is the July 4th for the nation of Israel. They left Egypt, and now they're going to be the people of God. Now they're going to be the nation of God. So Moses writes the first five books of the Bible, in part to help them understand who they are. And he has to let them know where they came from. He has to let them know, who is this God that has brought them out of Egypt? Who is this Yahweh that they worship? And so when we read the creation account, we have to, on one level, read it with the original recipients in mind. These are people that are starting a new life, a new country, beginning to be a new people. And the other thing that we have to realize is what's going on in this account is that one of the things Moses is doing, and this isn't everything, but one of the primary things he's doing is he's taking the various creation accounts that these people would be familiar with. Okay? If you study literature at all, you know that almost all ancient cultures have a creation story, right? Most cultures come up with some creation myth that explains why there's man and why there's woman and why babies happen and why there's rain and whatever, right? Most cultures have some type of creation account. What the account in Genesis is doing is essentially interacting with the different creation accounts of the people around Israel at this time and challenging them. So, for instance, there's an author who's done a lot of work on this, and he says there's five ways that the Genesis account repudiates or challenges the various cosmologies around Israel. Now, those are big words. So cosmology, you know, just creation story. How did the earth, how did everything come into being? He says there's five ways that this story challenges the stories that Israel wouldn't be familiar with. The Egyptian stories, the Babylonian stories, the Syrian stories, the Canaanite stories. Those are the ones they would know. Okay? First way, the Babylonian creation account speaks of dragons. It speaks of sea monsters. And in the Babylonian account, the Babylonian god defeats the sea monsters, and out of that creates everybody. Okay? That's their myth. They have a god who is in battle with the sea monsters, defeats those monsters, and then creates the world, asserts his power. Now, what does the Genesis account say? Does the god in Genesis battle sea monsters? Mm-hmm. What does he do?
Creates the sea.
He creates the sea. He creates the sea monsters. So these Israelites are living in a world where people say, my God battled and defeated the sea monsters. And Moses says, our God created the sea monsters. That's one way. One of the other creation accounts speaks of a god. There's this common ancient... The ancients thought of the world as basically having water below and water above. That was how all of the ancient world, in this part of the world anyway, conceived of the earth. They thought of land as basically floating on the water. So all of land was an island in their view. And because it rained, they thought there was water above that somehow got kept above and sometimes fell, right? This is how ancients thought of the world. There's water below, there's water above. So many of the ancient creation accounts had stories of the god separating the waters above and the waters below. And for most of them, it was a struggle. It was this battle. It was this kind of intense thing to separate these waters. Well, then you read about Israel's God. What does Israel's God do?
Created the waters.
Yeah. And how does he separate them? What was that?
He spoke?
He spoke.
Oh, got it.
He said, you go there, you go there. And it's done. Mm-hmm. Several ancient cultures also worshipped the celestial bodies. They worshipped the sun, they worshipped the moon, they worshipped the stars. Particularly Egypt, one of Egypt's main gods was the sun god. Okay? Now Moses writes this account. God tells about who he is, and what does he say? Does he worship the sun and the moon?
No.
He creates them, right? Does he? Well, what's interesting about what he does, though? Verse 16 of chapter 1, God made two great lights, the greater light to govern the day and the lesser light to govern the night. We know what those are, right? It's the sun and the moon. But it doesn't call them by name, because the very names for sun and moon are the names of the gods. So he says, he created the greater light and the lesser light. You know what they are, but they're not gods. I'm the god, and I created them. A lot of these creation accounts, too, have these fancy incantations, essentially magic spells, like God brewed, their gods brewed the earth, or they cast these spells, or there are these kind of incantations or rituals they went through to create the earth. Again, Israel's God speaks, and the earth is created. Simple voice, simple command. Not magic, simple voice. Finally, and perhaps most importantly, most of the ancient cosmologies have the creation of man as a kind of afterthought or a accidental. Like, the gods were doing their stuff and they needed somebody to bring them the tea, and so they created man, type of thing, right? Or the gods were doing their stuff and somehow, like, something splintered off and became people. It was this very kind of accidental, inconsequential thing. But if you read Genesis 1 and then Genesis 2, you realize that these creation accounts culminate in the creation of man. Creation of man is the highlight, is the high point of these creation accounts. So much so that most people understand Genesis 1 to the first couple verses of Genesis 2 is kind of one version of the creation story. And then in Genesis 2, you pick up a second version that kind of drills down into what's really important. And what's really important is the creation of people. So Israel's God, the one true God, Yahweh, doesn't create people as kind of a inconsequence or an afterthought. The true God creates man and woman as the culmination, the pinnacle of his creation. So Genesis walks through these things. It walks through, it challenges these creation stories that Israel might be familiar with. Question I have for us is, if that's true, and the point of this chapter is that God created us, not these other gods, that this God, the one true God, the God of Israel, created us, what are the creation stories that are floating around our world? Every culture has them. I think we do too. What are they? What are the creation myths?
Evolution, Big Bang, I mean, that, what are you talking about?
Sure. Okay. So evolution?
I would beg to differ that that's a myth, but I don't know.
Not so much the mechanism, but the source.
Okay.
So in a scientific
Darwinism,
moment,
I mean
Darwinism. Okay.
Okay.
So what's the source? Where does creation happen? I mean, is there
mutated amoebas, some dust particles miraculously spawning?
Sure. So chance, right?
Yeah, chance.
Chance. Okay.
Okay.
What else? Don't think just creation of the world, but creation of people, and not just. Our myths are a little more sophisticated than, you know, gods fighting dragons. What are some of the other myths that we have?
Reincarnation.
Okay. Sure. So some people believe that people die and they get reincarnated and you kind of earn points in one life that are then used in the next life.
This might be gone on a limb, but culturally speaking, how America became America. Manifest destiny.
Good.
We take what we can mm-hmm. from others. You know,
yeah.
And that's how it was done. That's how
mm-hmm. There's some privilege behind that, right?
Yeah.
There's some sense of, yeah, manifest destiny is a very kind of self-centered, mm-hmm. there's some divine.
What was the proverb they always, God helps those that help themselves. Mm-hmm. Part of why I felt feel that the rationalization of all that. So.
Yeah.
What about angels?
Okay. You mean
the Elohim?
Mm-hmm.
Do you think they create angels?
The Elohim?
Yeah, the cherubim, the seraphim, the both.
No, the Elohim is actually the word for God. So when that's what's used in Genesis 1, but that's a reference to God, not his angels. But there are cherubim and seraphim. There are other angelic beings that are created, but they're not mentioned until later. And they're not ever given the same. In fact, even in Hebrews, it says that man is created above the angels. And so there's this sense of man as being more significant, more important.
Because I was listening to this guy, and he was telling me, this video I was watching, he was talking about in the Hebrew text at the beginning of Genesis, it says in aforetime instead of in the beginning. Mm-hmm.
In the forward time?
In aforetime instead of in the beginning. It's it more references what was life before Adam and Eve. Mm. You know, the seven the 7 days, but the periods or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm just referencing that.
Yeah, that's interesting. It'd be interesting to hear his reasoning. The word is pretty clearly kind of it's a before, but it's kind of in the beginning, in the kind of first thing that God existed previous to anything else existing. So that's kind of what the word is trying to get at. What else? What's another creation myth that we have? Anything else?
What's the Americans grow up with this? Isn't there like some lumberjack and his big blue ox?
Paul Bunyan.
Yes, we're a guy.
Yeah, let's talk about the Grand Canyon, right? Because he drives his ox through
Really?
Yeah, so we got the Grand Canyon supposedly because he was dragging his ox behind him.
Yeah, that's a good one.
Okay. The stork.
What's that?
The stork.
The stork? Okay, good.
The stork.
I think there's essentially two main. We've talked about one of them. The other one's a little bit more abstract, but I think there's two main creation myths that we encounter in our world. First is the one you mentioned at first, that creation is by chance. So there's no. And I'm not dealing particularly with the method of creation, evolution versus 7 days versus however many million years, but that it's the impetus for creation is chance. Okay? That's one myth, that things just happened, right? The other one I would say is maybe a little more abstract, but it's that we create ourselves. Okay? Mm-hmm. And so this is actually very common. And
who do you want to be?
Yeah.
Lots of books on that.
Mm-hmm.
Store.
The American Dream, right?
Yeah.
You can be anything you want to be.
Become a better you.
Become a better you. Yeah, this kind of idea that who you are is up to you. You become what you want to be. And there's this video. I just thought of this. I wish I'd remembered it so I could have looked it up. Where the bleep does it?
Oh, what the bleep?
What the bleep or something? No, there's it's a fuller title.
I have watched it before. It's they're trying to relate science and religion from quantum mechanics.
Yeah, it's like, yeah.
What the bleep do we know?
Just what the bleep?
What the bleep do we know?
Yeah, that's something like that.
Yeah,
I
watched
it. It's interesting. It's quantum physics meets kind of Eastern philosophy, essentially. Is that kind of?
Yeah.
Nina doesn't agree.
Oh, go ahead.
But one of this guy, this movie, you have a physicist who talks about in the morning, every morning before he gets out of bed, he projects his day. So he kind of writes the script for his day, and he says, this is how my day is going to go.
And then he gets hit by a car.
Well, no, because then he wouldn't be doing this video. But then he kind of what? So he kind of creates himself, right? He runs through how his day is going to be, and then he can walk into that, and he can kind of experience this. So there's this strong idea of, like, I create myself. And to some extent, this is pretty pervasive in our American Western culture, I think. You go to college, and you kind of find yourself and figure out who you are, and there's this deep sense of, like, I need to create something, I need to become something, I need to achieve something. So I want to look at those two ideas. First of all, is that chance created us. And what Genesis does is it argues, in the same way that it argues against Babylonian creation myths, it argues directly against that creation myth. It says, no, you didn't just happen. God created us. There is this God, and he is the God who is bigger than all the gods around. He is the one who created you. So that One of the fascinating things about Genesis 1 is the repetition and the order and the structure. So you have all this parallelism. You have these 6 days that creation happens, and you have this strong parallelism that on the first day something happens that mirrors what happens on the fourth day. On the second day something happens that mirrors the fifth day. On the third day something happens that mirrors the sixth day. So you get this kind of parallels between the days. And everything builds up to the seventh day. And on the seventh day, you get told about that in the first 3 verses of chapter 2, all of which in the Hebrew have numbers of words in multiples of seven. And that each verse has the adjective seventh. And there's all this kind of cool, like, structural parallelism and stuff that highlights. And one of the reasons that's happening is because a lot of the other gods, a lot of the other creation accounts, things just kind of tumble out, like mountains just kind of happen, and there's all this kind of just stuff. But what's going on here is it's not chance, but this God, the God of Israel, is a God of order. It's a God that starts with chaos over the chaotic sea, which is an ancient kind of symbol for chaos and uncontrollableness, and he creates order from that. He structures the earth. He gives it rules. He gives it meaning. One of the interesting ways that what's happened in history is that it's actually this type of cosmology, kind of a Judeo-Christian view of the world that views creation as ordered, that has led to most of modern science. So other kind of creation stories around the world have a much more kind of, particularly some Eastern cosmologies, have a much more kind of unknowableness of the world. The world is immaterial at best. The world is kind of, at its heart, chaotic. But the Judeo-Christian, the Genesis account says, no, the world is ordered. The world is structured, and it's structured by an intelligent being. So that, early in the kind of late Middle Ages, that's what led people to start saying, well, if the world is ordered, then I can know the world. I can understand that order. And I can do things that will then help me to predict how that order comes out. So that's kind of the basis for modern science. So it's one of these kind of ironies of history that, in some sense, the Christian creation account is what led to modern science, which now people say,
using to refute the creation account. Yeah.
And now you say, well, science and faith are battling it out, and there's all these debates about how science and faith are incompatible, and yet science in some ways arose from this type of faith perspective of how the world was created. But what this means to us is that our lives have order. Our lives have a creator who established them. And because of that, life has meaning. So because God is a God of order, because God is a God who created everything and structured everything, our lives have meaning. And not just life in general, but our lives. The life of individuals. The life of each person. The God that creates and structures and takes care in creating all the animals, that gives us value. When we went to India about a month ago, the team went to an area of the country that had historically and still does practice something that's very common in India. There's actually been some marches, I think, in San Francisco recently about this, but female infanticide. So essentially, if you are having a child, you'd much rather be a male because males contribute to your family, they earn, whereas if you have a daughter, you actually have to pay for her to get married. So in this culture, having a daughter is much less desired. So this particular area of India, and others as well, is very frequent to essentially murder your infant daughters because they would just cost your family. At the same time, when you're in India and you're on a busy highway, a cow crosses the street and everybody stops. And you can't even shoo the cow on because that would be dishonoring of the cow. And so you wait and everybody waits. And I don't say that to mock this culture as if it's ridiculous, but just to say that seems appalling to us because of the God that has shaped our culture. A lot of Western culture, a lot of the culture we live in is shaped by this creation cosmology. And we look at that and we say, no, you should not be killing baby girls and honoring the cow. We say there's something wrong with that. And so we have marches in San Francisco to say, stop female infanticide in India. But that's only because of what we believe about who God is and how he created people. And our culture has drifted from those roots, but a lot of the kind of values implicit in that remain. So the fact that God created us and our God is a God of order gives us value, gives individuals value. It's interesting, this just along those lines. This is a quote from Mahatma Gandhi, who's a pretty phenomenal man. He said, if someone were to ask me the most important outward manifestation of Hinduism was, I would suggest that it was the idea of cow protection. That's what Gandhi says. Gandhi is famous for his nonviolent political efforts, for essentially helping India to become independent. He says the most important outward manifestation of Hinduism is that you protect cows. That's an interesting statement. So, God creates us. We're not created by chance. That's one of the myths, I think, that Genesis corrects for us. The other myth is that we create ourselves. And this is something that I think is pretty deep in all of us. And we even sometimes fall into it in Christian settings, I think. We kind of fall into the same type of thinking of I need to kind of figure out who I'm going to be, figure out who God wants me to be. And sometimes we get very much in this kind of, we get lulled in this way of thinking where we are determining ourselves. We are creating ourselves.
Sorry, Paul. Mm-hmm. Do you have any more context on that quote from Gandhi?
I don't, actually. I'm sorry. I can look it up.
Okay. I mean, I can look it up, too. But
I actually respect Gandhi a lot. I was surprised to find this quote. I was looking for a quote.
Like, what question was asked? Or, like because I feel like I just would want to know
yeah.
more context.
Yeah, okay. I'll try and do some research on that.
Okay, well,
it's a fair question. It was from an article in PBS, I think, that I have the web link that I got it from.
PBS, television?
Yeah. So this other idea, that we create ourselves, that we are ultimately responsible for figuring out who we are. And Genesis says that it's not just that other gods didn't create people, didn't create the earth, but that this God did, and he created everything, and then he created people. And so not only are people created by this God, but people aren't God, right? God created us, so we are not God. We have been created by some other who is bigger than us, who has created us, who is sovereign in ways that we aren't sovereign. I was doing a little bit of research to find this out, and I found, you're familiar with WikiHow? It's like Wikipedia, but it's like, you know, how do I plunge my toilet or whatever? Well, there's a WikiHow, it's very interesting. I wish I could read it all. It's like this, it's called How to Find Yourself. And it's a...
I just read one last week. It was called I Don't Know How I Stumbled Upon It. I was not looking it up for myself. It was How to Be Manly. And they basically quoted the tenets of Boy Scouts. You know,
really?
Kind, courteous, obedient, reverent, brave, whatever.
Those
are. I thought it was really interesting. Yeah. I didn't think that something like that would have existed. How to be manly. So.
Yeah.
Anyway, go ahead.
Yeah.
Sorry.
So this was How to Find Yourself. And it gave these detailed steps about how to, like, kind of walk through your life and figure out who you want to be and kind of basically write the map for your life. And I just found myself reading this and my overwhelming thought was, boy, that sounds exhausting. What a pain. And that's really one of the implications of, if you have to create yourself, man, that is the work of a God. That is hard work. I think a lot of the struggle, a lot of the frustration and torture that some of us feel is that weight of having to create yourself, having to figure out who you are. having to kind of establish you as something different than everybody else and whatever. Give yourself value by what you make of yourself. In contrast to that, being created, if you understand yourself as having been created by an other, I think the implication is that you can rest in that. It's a restful sense of, there still might be some level of self-discovery or kind of understanding that creation, but it's, you were created by an other. There's someone else who designed you. And I find that incredibly freeing, because it means that ultimately it's not up to me. I don't have to make sure I become what I want to become. The truth is that I'm probably not going to be what I want to become, but I get to figure out who it is that God created me to be. The other implication of the fact that I'm created is that there's some purpose, right? Things are created for a purpose. So all of this is to kind of start to lead us in that direction. If God created us, then the implication is that there is purpose behind our creation. So when you open up a factory and you start building something, you don't just build things to build things. You build things to do something. You create something for some reason, for some purpose, to be useful, to be used, to be something. I think it was probably Ava's first birthday, but we had, one of my children had their first birthday, and we had this little, like, ribbon, that was like, it's like a first place ribbon or something, but it said, happy first birthday on it, right? So we, like, I think we'd given it to her, it was on one of her presents, but it was really funny, because there was this, you know, it was like a nylon ribbon in an angle, and a little circle thing up here, but then we turn it over, it says, not intended for use by children under 3. It's like, wait, it says happy first birthday. How can I not give it to someone under 3? I said, sometimes you create things and you don't think about the purpose very well. But the idea that we are created by God implies then that we have some purpose, that we have some reason behind us. So I want to read one more passage before we're done to kind of start to move us in that direction. This is where we'll be expanding as we move forward. But this is Genesis 1, 27 through 31. And I'll read it. So God created man in his own image. In the image of God, he created him. Male and female, he created them. God blessed them and said to them, be fruitful and increase in number. Fill the earth and subdue it. Rule over the fish of the sea and the birds of the air and over every living creature that moves on the ground. Then God said, I give you every seed-bearing plant on the face of the whole earth and every tree that has fruit with seed in it. They will be yours for food. And to all the beasts of the earth and all the birds of the air and all the creatures that move on the ground, everything that has the breath of life in it, I give every green plant for food. And it was so. God saw all that he had made, and it was very good. And there was evening, and there was morning, the sixth day. So this is the pinnacle. The first five creation stories have been summed up by God saw that it was good. Now God creates man and woman, and the conclusion is, this is very good. This is the high point of his creation. And we see here kind of a three-part purpose in this passage, then we're going to expand out in kind of some other directions. But the first thing that we see about man and woman is that they are created with a unique relationship to God. So God says of man and woman, I created them in my image. That's said of none else, nothing else in his creation. So man and woman have this unique relationship to God. So that, I think it's accurate, Chris Tomlin's song, who says, you and I are made to worship. There is this unique relationship that man and woman has with God that nobody else, none of the other creation, shares. And what do you do when you're in a relationship with God? If he created you, what's the only way to relate to a god is worship. So there's this unique element that you and I are made to worship. That is part of this creation. But then there's a command given that God gives his new creation. He says, be fruitful and increase in number, fill the earth and subdue it, rule over the fish of the sea and the birds of the air and over every living creature that moves on the ground. So we have this unique relationship to God, but we also have a unique responsibility within creation. We have a command given to us that's not given to any other part of creation. And the command here has to do with dominion, it has to do with fruitfulness. And we're going to see how these themes work itself out in Genesis 2 next week when we start to look at our kind of topics. But the three topics we're looking at are work, community, and romance. And we're going to see how what is given here as the command for people gets played out in these areas. So that it's not incompatible to say that you and I are made to worship. But what does worship look like? It looks like work, looks like community, looks like romance, looks like getting together and singing to God, but we don't spend 15 minutes in worship and then go on with our lives. Our lives themselves are worship. They reflect who God is. They fulfill our purpose and then reflect on God. So such that worship is this all-encompassing thing. It's not something you do only when you sing songs. So we have this purpose, and then in the last part of this section, we see that we are given resources, right? Where if you start a job and they tell you, these are your responsibilities, yada, 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 go do it. No, they say, these are your responsibilities, yada, 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 and here's your, whatever you need to do your job, right? If you're a carpenter, they say, here's your hammer. If you're an engineer, they say, here's your computer. Whatever, you're given the resources to accomplish the task. Maybe sometimes you're not given the resources. If you're a teacher, they say, go for it, right? But in general, the way it should work is that you're given the resources to accomplish the task that you're charged with. So God gives people resources. I give you every seed-bearing plant. They will be yours, and to all the beasts of the earth. Everything that has the breath of life, I give every green plant for food. So God enables people with the resources they need to fulfill the responsibility he's given them. So I think some people see this idea that we were created with a purpose and they think, boy, that sounds limiting. They think, I don't want to be boxed in by some purpose that somebody else creates for me. I want to discover it myself. I want to create myself. I think some people say that, but I'd be interested in really going deeper in that idea because I don't think they really think that. And I think that when you get down to it, being created with a purpose is actually far more freeing than it is limiting. I was talking to a friend of mine who is a musician. This was a long time ago. He was telling me about a painting class he took because he's kind of an amateur folk musician and he was taking a painting class to kind of increase his creativity. But he's taking this painting class and he said their teacher gave him two assignments. The first assignment was, go paint something. And everybody in the class had an incredibly difficult time with it. The stuff that came back was like bizarre and unconnected. There wasn't a whole lot of creativity. It was just kind of a mess. The second assignment their professor gave them was, you have a 16 by 16 box. You may use these three colors, and you must paint something to do with flowers. And the things people brought back were the most creative, amazing things that you could imagine. And what the professor was trying to do was to try to get them to see that creativity flourishes within some parameters. That if you just give a blank piece of paper and say, go be creative, it's like, well, I don't know, what do I do? But when you're given some structures and limitations, then the creativity has this chance to express itself. So that you see all these different 16 by 16 boxes with the same three colors, and yet they're completely different conceptions of flowers. And that's what I think is true about us and our purpose, is that understanding that God creates us with this purpose actually gives us the freedom to be creative within that. Actually allows us to kind of flourish in this very creative sense. So the conclusion of this creation account then comes in Genesis 2, as I mentioned, and I actually want to read that as well, because this is the main takeaway that I want us to be thinking about. Thus the heavens and the earth were completed in all their vast array. By the seventh day, God had finished the work he had been doing. So on the seventh day, he rested from all his work. And God blessed the seventh day and made it holy, because on it he rested from all the work of creating that he had done. The Sabbath rest became for Israel the distinctive element of their religion. A lot of ancient religions had temples. A lot of ancient religions had sacrifices. A lot of ancient religions had some sense of law. Nobody took a day a week off. That was crazy. In an agricultural environment, nobody stopped working an entire day. And then to leave your fields fallow for an entire year, every seventh year, was even more ridiculous. The Sabbath became the most distinctive element of Jewish religion in that part of the world. And I think the Sabbath flows from the creation as a very direct consequence. Because if God created us, if we weren't created by chance, we don't have to create ourselves, then what's the consequence? We can rest. We don't have to figure everything out. We have a God who is sovereign, who creates us, who creates the world. So there's work to be done. It's not Club Med all week. There is a responsibility, there is a charge, but at the end of the week, there's a rest. To remember that God is God, we are not God. He created us. He is the one who is bigger than any of the other gods. And he is the one who created us. So my encouragement for us is to rest in our createdness. This is a cool thing that kind of God does. I was sat down to coffee with a friend yesterday, one of the college students I work with, and she's a senior. And I was just asking, how's it going? How's it been? And she said, I didn't get the exact words, but I wasn't talking about any of this, and she said something like this. I feel like lately I have a deeper sense of being created by God, and that means I can't be shaken by the things going on in my life. Hmm. And I said, can I write that down? I feel like I have a deeper sense of being created by God, and that means I can't be shaken. I can rest. Things can happen, and I can withstand them. I can weather them, I can navigate them, because I understand my createdness. So my encouragement for us is to rest in our createdness, and then to rest in our purpose. To rest in this idea that we have purpose. And that's kind of the journey that we're going to be entering into, is what is that purpose? And how does our work that we spend a lot of time doing, how does that glorify God? Is it just that we have to do this so that we can come to YAF or go to church or go evangelize or go serve? And this work thing is just something you have to kind of do because everybody's got to do it, but then you can get on with like the real stuff? I don't think so. That's not the way Genesis is written. What about community? You know, is it kind of like, well, it'd just be a lot better if I could just do God's work by myself, but I got to be with people, so I got to figure this out, and then a conflict happens, and so, you know, you kind of have to do that, but then we can do what's really spiritual. No. I don't think that's not how Genesis presents the creation of people. And then even more so, there's this whole kind of romantic thing, that sometimes you want more than anything, and sometimes you want to be completely gone more than anything, and out of your life, and you wrestle with, is it right, and should I be pursuing this, should I not, why is it so frustrating at times, but it can be fun, but I want it to be fun, but it's not always, and how do I do this? And is that just distracting me from God? Is that distracting me from what I'm created to do? How does dating somebody or getting married fit into serving God? Well, I think we'll see it does, that it's wrapped up in this purpose that God created us for. So that's where we're headed. I do have a few discussion questions for tonight. We can break up into groups. They essentially have to do with figuring out what is this, how does this affect us? The fact that we are created, how does that help us? Does that do anything for me personally? What are the, I think my first question is, what are the particular creation myths of this culture that affect you, that you are tempted to believe, and that remembering that God created you might counteract in some way? So let me pray for us. I mentioned a couple implications of the idea that God created us. There's lots of others. There's lots of other implications that follow from this very compact, very powerful idea. Talk about some of the others. And then maybe talk about how you spend your time. What do you do? What fills up most of your time? And how does that relate to this phrase that we saw God give Adam and Eve? Be fruitful and multiply, increase in number and rule the earth. What does that seem like? It has anything to do with fixing bugs or teaching kindergartners or whatever you do with most of your time? So talk about that a little bit. But let me pray for us first. God, thanks for this passage. Thanks that you are a God who created us, that you love us, that you created us, that you are big and sovereign, and you give us purpose. Pray that as we start this journey together, that you would help us to understand that purpose and to know you through it, to know who you are, and to know how you've created us. So be with us in this, Father. In Jesus' name, amen.